Welcome to BDO in the Boardroom, a podcast series for board of directors and those charged with governance. Each episode features a topical discussion with board peers and subject matter experts on both trending and timeless boardroom issues, covering a myriad of issues, including, but not limited to, mitigating risk in the increasingly digital world, navigating your board career, from landing your first board seat to succession planning in support of the next generation, to other top-of-mind issues such as ESG reporting, shareholder activism, and the insights we share through the BDO Center for Corporate Governance and Financial Reporting. Be sure to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes or Spotify. Let's get started.
Hello, I'm Amy Rojic, Director of BDO Center for Corporate Governance, and happy to have the chance to sit down with Patricia Gorham, co-lead of the U.S. and Global Professional Liability Practice of Evershed Sutherland, and my colleague, Holly Carr, Managing Director within BDO's Forensic Practice, to discuss how audit committees should handle allegations of fraud or illegal acts. Before we begin today, let me introduce my two guests. Patty has more than 35 years of experience representing clients in high-stakes, complex business litigation. Her areas of focus include antitrust, accounting liability, and securities fraud class actions, and she serves clients across a variety of industries. Holly's career has spanned over two decades as an auditor to financial statements and a preparer for a Fortune 300 company, as well as a regulator at the SEC's Division of Enforcement, and she's currently serving for BDO as a forensic accountant with interests in ESG disclosures and metrics, financial statements, SEC reporting, whistleblower matters, as well as internal controls. So Patty and Holly, welcome you both to the program today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to jump right in. And I think my first question, and maybe Holly, I'll ask you to kick it off, is how common is it for the audit committee to receive a tip or other information that alleges fraud or an illegal act? And where might this type of tip originate?
I think it's extremely common. And I think one of the reasons it is so common is that the origin of a tip like this has many sources, right? So when I think about this, in the most common places is this might filter up through internal audit. Right, internal audit has an issue, they're going to bring it to the audit committee. Your external auditor could come to the audit committee and say they have concerns that an allegation of fraud has been made to them, and now they're passing that along. You also have in-house counsel, which possibly could be through the company's internal whistleblower hotline. Those programs are more robust than ever, and so the volume that they see is quite high in some larger organizations, so that's another outlet that we could see. And then some other areas would be executives themselves. You know, executives, their emails are out to the company or out in the public facing. They get a lot of tips that way. Lawsuits, or often now increasingly we see some shareholder or attorney demand letters. So these are all channels that I think the audit committee regularly receives tips from.
Right. And I guess from your perspective, Patty, you know, maybe you give us a little bit of more of a flavor for the types and tips and allegations.
Sure, Amy. I mean, you know, good governance really requires that a company have in place a structure that allows for fraud or illegal acts to be reported appropriately. And so in that sense, an audit committee wants to be receiving those tips, at least where appropriate. Now, not all tips are going to be the same. There's a difference between, let's say, a minor employee theft, which may be an illegal act, but is not the same as a kind of a illegal act or fraud that might impact your financial statements in a significant way. But you want to make sure that all those tips are getting reported and are going up to the appropriate level and then and being handled. What's key, I think, is for audit committees to think in advance about how they want to handle them, how they want to sort through them, what procedures they want to put in place once those tips are received. And I think we'll talk a little bit more about that in this podcast.
So I guess maybe the next question, logical question, is why are these types of tips often shared with the audit committee to begin with?
Right. I mean, because, as I said, you want an appropriate reporting chain, but also because often these kinds of tips are associated with the financial position of the company, right? They either numerically impact your financial statements or they impact your internal controls that are related to financial reporting. They impact the management's kind of demeanor and the environment that they have. And so part of good governance is knowing what's going on and making sure that if those tips do come in, they're being appropriately investigated, that their external auditors are put on alert when they need to be, and regulators are informed when they need to be. So that is why I think it's important for them to come up to an audit committee. You also tend to have folks on the audit committee that have a little bit of expertise. And I know Holly has a lot to say about that.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I've dealt with hundreds and hundreds of whistleblowers in my career. You know, I spent a good amount of my career interviewing them and assessing their allegations. And I think oftentimes whistleblowers in particular, tipsters, whether they're whistleblower or not, but internally and within the company, they come forward to the audit committee because they really view the audit committee as an independent body, independent of management, and that they have the ability and they have the power to hold management accountable and to really view it as, you know, from an independent lens. So I think that the audit committee is often a choice target, you know, to receive these tips from whistleblowers because they do feel like they can have some sort of impact in their role and that they have the right level of authority to make change. So I think that's something that I see oftentimes. And of course, audit committees are required to have financial experts because we are talking very commonly about financial impact. In the biggest cases, restatements of financials. And so when you think about that, the audit committee is the right place. And so when you have people coming forward that are maybe accountants, plant managers, things like that, that are a little bit knowledgeable about the company's financials, they know the audit committee exists, what they're supposed to be doing. So they're going to reach out through that path.
So I guess once an allegation is alleged, what are the first steps that the audit committee should take when it receives the fraud tip?
I think the first step is absolutely just stay calm, right? This is commonplace. You know, if you're new to the audit committee, you know, you'll quickly get adapted to this is going to happen, right? So stay calm, right? This is a common occurrence and you're going to have the resource to address it. Part of that is also to respond timely. Timely response is absolutely critical for a couple of reasons. One, if the allegation is true, you can limit the scope and impact of the fraud if it's ongoing, right? You can limit your losses. You can limit, you know, if it's someone's theft of materials, things like that. You want to get after this quickly, right? To limit the impact of the fraud. And if you can limit it, then maybe you might have the ability to avoid, you know, an issuance of misstated financials. Can you catch it before the financials go out the door and make corrections that you need to make and avoiding a restatement, right? That's a very costly, timely issue that you could have. And it also impacts, you know, the company's, you know, how they're viewed in the market, right? So you don't want that. And you want to stay ahead of your regulators. As a former regulator, the quicker and more timely that boards can respond, the better the response is, right? Because you are getting on top of it. You're meeting your expectations and your obligations as a board member and an audit committee member in particular. So I think those are some of the critical is really stay calm and start really to approach this in a timely manner for a variety of reasons. And then once you get after that, I think, you know, now you're getting going. The second step is really you have to start evaluating the scope and the context of the issue that's being raised to you. Everything is not created equal. Like Patty mentioned, it can be very minor things that end up in the audit committee, very material things and very sensitive things that could involve some of maybe the executives. There could be a non-public, you know, transaction the company's engaged in that there's questions regarding. So you do want to make sure that you're really looking at these allegations critically and assessing the scope, but also looking at the macro and micro environment in which the company is operating. Does this sound about right? Right? Is there current pressure? Are we doing this type of work, a new transaction? Do we have some concerns about a particular product line that now is being raised up that we knew about previously? So you want to make sure you're looking at the data, not just the allegation itself, but all the other contacts that you have, information you have to really assess that. So that's something to be thinking about. This is a pattern of behavior. You know, there are some instances where you have maybe some higher risk operating units or you have some higher risk countries in which your company is functioning and there's patterns of behavior there and the allegation really is fitting that mold. And so that's going to make this a little bit more serious of an allegation when you get into it. And then what is the motivation of the reporting party? That's always something that we look at, especially in whistleblower matter. What is the motivation? What other parties might be involved that we want to have exploratory conversations with? But I would also have a caution of like the motivation. Someone could be motivated financially. Maybe they go to a regulator that has a whistleblower program. That doesn't mean they're wrong, though. So be careful that these red herrings, maybe this employee doesn't have the best performance reviews and the tip that they're raising up. They could still be right. So make sure you're not discrediting the actual substance of the allegation by other information that's really not relevant to the allegation itself, but is kind of in the sphere of knowledge. So be very careful there. I think that's something to be mindful of.
Oh, great points. So Patty, maybe you can talk a little bit about the plan response.
Sure. And I want to say I love Holly's starting with stay calm because, you know, I've worked with external auditors and all kinds of messy situations. And my favorite auditor line is, well, we would want to know more about that, which is the equivalent of, oh my gosh, can you believe this? I think in auditor speak, but you do want to know more about it. So you want to plan your response. And it, you know, what Holly was just talking about in terms of understanding the scope and the context of the allegations is important because you've got some decisions that you need to make pretty quickly. One of those decisions is who's going to conduct the investigation. Is this a matter that can be handled with your internal systems? Is it something that human resources can handle? Is it something your internal audit group can handle? Is it something your internal general counsel can handle? Or is this more appropriate, you know, for a kind of external counsel to come in or an external forensic team? You have to decide, I think, you know, where, what level of the company is implicated potentially in the allegations so that you can decide what the appropriate response would be. If you think your upper management's implicated, if you think it's a company-wide issue, if you think the board is implicated, you sure are going to need to get independent counsel, independent forensic team involved pretty quickly. And you may need to set up a special committee of the board, or you may need to determine that the audit committee is the one that can hear their reports. But you've got to consider a reporting structure that will allow for somebody who is removed from the allegations to be evaluating what happens as a result of the investigation. You also pretty quickly need to decide what has to be done to preserve information, right? Because the investigation is going to involve interviewing witnesses. It's going to involve looking at documents. Increasingly, it involves not only emails, which when they first came along, when I was practicing, we thought there's no way we'll ever figure this out. And now it's TikToks and instant messaging and all kinds of social media. All of that may need to be preserved depending on what is the nature of the allegation, and again, who is alleged to have been implicated or involved around the allegations, so that you can make a decision to go ahead and preserve that material. You may need to image cell phones, you may need to image laptops, you may need to stop auto-delete on your systems that are in place, your computer systems that are in place. But if regulators are going to be involved, they're going to want to know you did that right away. If there's going to be litigation, they're going to want to know you did it right away. And if you're going to do a fair investigation, you're going to want to make sure that material isn't inadvertently or intentionally deleted and removed from that investigation. And then what's the scope of the investigation going to include? And I will say, and I've conducted a number of these investigations, they can get messy because you are tiptoeing through people's personal information on your way to looking at the allegations. And you often come across embarrassing details about employees and management or other issues that show up just from your review of the materials related to the allegations that have been identified. And so you have to be careful in planning the scope to, A, make sure you know what you need to do to get to an answer on the question at issue so that you don't get sidetracked by tangents. You may have to address those tangents in any event. You know, if you see another illegal act, you're going to have to raise that. And, you know, that's going to have to go through its own process. If it's just an embarrassing or salacious detail, you may be able to, you know, deal with that in a fairly simple way, but you want your scope to be defined from the outset. If it's going to be a matter that's going to have to be reported to a regulator or to the external auditors or lender or anybody outside of the company, you're going to want to really consider whether the scope of the investigation is going to satisfy those stakeholders. If it's, for example, an external auditor or a regulator that happens to know the allegation's been made, you may want to involve them. You may want to say, this is our plan. You know, are you comfortable with it, or do you want to give us feedback? The regulators probably won't commit to doing that, but they might give you a couple of criticisms. An external auditor will often give you some guidance on what they think needs to be included. But you want to make sure your investigation is going to satisfy the people that it needs to satisfy in the end. If you do that process appropriately, you know, you'll have a better chance of being able to constrain the investigation in the sense of, you know, reining in costs, sticking to a budget, and sticking to minimal tangents and really focusing on what needs to be dealt with.
Great. Thank you. Maybe Holly, you probably can share some of the better practices that you've seen from clients that you've worked with.
Yeah, and I think my best tip here, my pro tip, is to have a playbook for these situations that you can just activate in advance. You do not want to be building the plane and flying the plane at the same time, right? So you will feel calmer. You will feel more in control of the situation if you have discussed how, as an audit committee, you're going to handle this in advance. And you've gotten some great tips probably from your general counsel. Maybe your chief internal auditor could help you. External audit as well might give you some tips of, like, what is this checklist? Obviously, document preservation is on the checklist. A communication strategy is going to be on the checklist. Limiting scope. What types of vendors do we maybe already have arrangements with that we could call upon, right, that we think that would be appropriate? So having this playbook will really ease your mind that makes sure that you're considering all of the things when you're in that moment. So having it in advance, educating the audit committee about it, especially if you have new members join, take a moment, you know, as part of your onboarding to familiarize them with this playbook should these types of issues arise.
Oh, great. Good suggestions there. So early on, you mentioned the need or potential need for an independent investigation. Maybe you can expand on that concept and really give us an idea of what makes an investigation independent and why is it so critical?
Sure. I mean, it's not critical in every right. situation, but an independent investigation is what is required if an allegation implicates management, member of the board, can implicate owners. It can be company-wide. It is an investigation that takes that investigative process out of folks that have other motivations related to the company and really puts it in the hands of counsel and forensic professionals who are responsible to the company, right? The company is the client, not management, not board, not somebody in the chain of command that you're supposed to report to within the company structure. And that's what makes it independent. And knowing that your client is the company and not somebody else who's otherwise a big shot at the company is important for allowing the investigation to fully explore those kinds of allegations. It helps you deal with when you find tangential information or salacious details. I've been involved in one that turned up the CEO engaged in an inappropriate relationship with employees. You know, that it was important that we were independent in that situation. And so that's kind of what it is. Why do you choose one? Again, it's a matter that's material to the company, to the performance of the company. It's a matter that's going to be reported to a regulator, to a lender, to the shareholders. It's a matter that potentially implicates upper management or board members. It's a particularly sensitive issue and or specialized expertise is required. It's the kind of investigation where you need particular forensic capability, for example. So that's when you would use one. Objectivity is key there. Independence is key there. The other thing that it is important here is that it will help you maintain account and client privilege to the extent you want to do that here. When you're conducting an independent investigation, the company holds that privilege. And so the work of the attorneys and the work of the professionals who are hired by the attorneys in those situations, so your forensic team, is subject to that privilege, and then it is up to the company whether or not it wants to waive that privilege. Now, if you're reporting to a regulator, you may get some pretty heavy pressure to go ahead and waive the privilege, but it is the company's privilege and it is theirs to waive, and it won't be a decision that is made because of the interests of an individual within the company. And so when you have that kind of independent investigation, you get to make those decisions with the company's interests foremost.
Oh, thank you. And I know there's a lot going on right now, Holly, in kind of the regulatory and accounting aspects of this. Maybe you can give us some thoughts on what's happening in that realm.
Yeah, thanks, Amy. I mean, we've definitely seen some changes on what we refer to as NOCLAR, right? This is this concept that, you know, your auditor has raised up a concern of an illegal act. It's an alleged illegal act. They don't have to be confident that it is occurring. They just have to have concern that it is possibly occurring and it's ongoing. it's not been addressed. And so we've seen changes by the AICPA. So this is really impacting audits of what we think of private companies, non-public companies, and the regulations around there. And it's really upping the standard by which if you become aware of a potential illegal act that you have to take action, right? You have to internally report, and that's going to have to be handled. What we see is also the PCAOB and the SEC are very focused on how companies and audit committees are handling these types of notices of potential legal acts, right? So we think of Section 10A of the Securities and Exchange Act really highlights that this is an expectation that companies and audit committees address this, right? And that time you have to, if your external auditor feels like it's not being addressed appropriately, they have an obligation then to report to the regulator that this has not been resolved, right, to their satisfaction. So you don't want to be in that territory. So that's why staying calm, using an independent investigator when it's a material, potentially material issue, but also having this independent will give you a defensible and kind of objective report that you can share with regulators if you need to at some point down the road. So those are some of the benefits when you're dealing with a potential illegal act in this no-clar space.
No, that makes a lot of sense. So I guess maybe we'll move on to when and with whom should the audit committee be communicating during this process? And I think this is a particularly important thing because there's a sequencing here. So, Patty, I'll let you maybe kick that off.
Sure. And you may get different answers depending on the nature of the investigation. Right. So if you've got a, you know, if you've got a very minor matter, maybe something that can be handled internally, it may be something that can be handled not by your general counsel, HR. And then I think the audit committee is going to want a final report or a periodic report, perhaps, if it's going to take long. But if it's an internal investigation that's at, you know, a little more serious, it's at the counsel level, it's going to take a long period of time. You do want to establish some kind of regular schedule for updates. It may depend on the nature of the particular allegations and something Holly alluded to earlier, which is, do you have some reporting deadline looming? How fast do you need to go? You want to handle it promptly. But you do want to hear periodically how it's going, where they are in the plan, what the facts are showing, whether there have been any surprises. And generally, you want that communication to come through counsel so that you can, again, protect the privilege unless and until you want to waive that privilege. If the investigation's independent, you do want to let your team do its work, but you, again, still want to have some periodic communications. You want to understand at the planning process, you want to be involved in the planning process, you want to understand exactly what it is the team intends to do. And you want to, yourself, the committee, you want to assess whether you think that's sufficient, a sufficient plan. And then you want to hear periodically where they are in implementing that plan. Again, who they've interviewed, what documents they've looked at, whether they think additional effort is required, and whether they've reached preliminary conclusions. Then at the end of that process, you'll want a full report. Again, you're trying to protect privilege. You want that to come through counsel generally. We often give reports to audit committees verbally and not in writing to help facilitate that process. The regulators have bounced around a little bit on how hard they will push. I see Holly laughing at me, being as she was a former regulator. There was certainly a period where they were hardcore to, you must waive privilege with respect to everything. There was a period where they were hardcore on, you must waive privilege with respect to any facts you gathered, but you can keep your opinion to yourself. So that process of determining what you're going to share with the regulator and how much will depend on the nature of the allegations. It'll depend on whether you're throwing yourself on the mercy of the regulator, asking for leniency or cooperation credit, or telling them, no, there's nothing here. These are not the droids you were looking for. So, but you want to protect all of that information so that you can make that decision.
And I think
I like
one
the
of the
Star
other
Wars
things,
reference. Sorry, Holly, go ahead.
I think one of the other things the board wants to know, and they want regular updates, you know, I'm the forensic accountant, right? In a lot of these situations, they want to know if you have any challenges, right? Do you have uncooperative individuals? Because that's going to slow down your ability to, you know, complete this investigation, which might be holding up the issuance of an audit opinion, could be holding up the issuance of maybe the 10K, a quarter. Or, you know, maybe they're getting ready to, this is pre-IPO, right? A lot of these matters do fall out pre-IPO, and that can delay. I've seen a couple have delayed the IPO. That's hard to explain to the market why you're going a month later than you'd originally announced. So I think something you want to know is the audit committee definitely wants to know, is my internal, you know, is my investigators, are they having problems? Are they hitting roadblocks? Where are they facing resistance? Does that make sense? Or does that make me more concerned? Did we find that a lot of data had been deleted after the preservation hold went out? I think an audit committee would want to know that. Who deleted? Did they not get the notice? Were they intentionally not complying with it? Do we need to suspend people at this point because they're not really cooperating? So I think the audit committee has just not a, okay, update me. They also need to be aware of, hey, we're having challenges. We need assistance here. We're going to need some additional leverage pushed down so we can continue and complete this investigation timeline. So that's something to be thinking about too. That's are some of the challenges I've seen. Patty, I would imagine you have also encountered these.
Oh, those are great points. No, and I mean, you know, there are times when you do have to make some personnel changes, whether it's a suspension or otherwise, because you're not done your entire investigation, but you see that there are enough roadblocks being put in place, or there's enough evidence already that the person needs to be removed from, say, a financial reporting chain, and you just need to take care of that right away. And that clearly is something an audit committee would want to know sooner rather than later. And you're absolutely 100% right on the document preservation issue. There's a kind of a stereotypical saying in law that, you know, more people go to jail for the cover-up, right, than the crime. And it's true, right, that a lot of folks get in trouble because they deleted the document on purpose or not, and regulators decidedly don't like it. Litigants, you know, the other side doesn't like it. Shareholders don't like it. And so if that happens, I think the audit committee would want to know that right away so they could understand that and understand the potential ramifications and whether there's anything that can be done on a remedial basis to try to salvage the situation.
You talked about a few things there and you brought up stakeholders. So maybe my next question would be, when do you need to consider, you know, if you must communicate with other stakeholders, what does that look like?
Well, I think you need to consider that from the get-go, right? I mean, I think it's part of your planning process. You need to be making a list of who are the potential stakeholders here. Do I have a 10-K coming up? Do I have a filing obligation? Am I a public company that's reporting to the SEC? Am I a private company, but I'm answering to my lenders? You know, are there other regulators that are implicated in these potential allegations? Who are my stakeholders? Do I have shareholders that are going to need to know on a timely basis? They may need to know about the allegation, they may need to know about the investigation, and then they may need to know about the conclusion. And so, yeah, you've got to start from the beginning about, you know, listing who those potential stakeholders are. When are they going to hear? Well, that's going to depend on a lot of things, right? You know, I think in most cases, if the allegations are serious enough, and an independent committee has been formed or a special committee is going to be formed, you're going to find that you have some kind of reporting obligation to those stakeholders. And the nature of it, again, will depend on your particular situation as a company. Do you have to file an 8K? Do you have to take some other step to let people know what's going on? Is it a closely held corporation, but you better tell the owners? You know, so you want to consider that right away. And then at the end, obviously, all of those stakeholders are entitled to receive some kind of final report on what you found or didn't find.
Got it. So I've heard a lot today, and I appreciate you talking about some of the time frame that it's really challenging to figure out. And I'm just thinking out loud here, but in looking kind of at the recent rules around cybersecurity and the very condensed time frame for reporting of material incidents, and of course, determining how something becomes material is challenging on its own. I would imagine that in these types of investigations, it could be very challenging to know how far these go and how material it could be to the organization. So any thoughts on what you've seen in your experience with that, Holly or Patty?
You know, I think materiality is a hard question, right? I've calculated materiality, you know, for goodwill impairment. I've calculated materiality for EPS, you know, is it really a rounding error? Is it a misstatement? It is hard, but I think you don't do it alone. You don't go this alone. You let your general counsel have part of this conversation. You might have external counsel at this point. But you need to bring in your SEC reporting team if you're a public company and their views of materiality, right? And what they're hearing, you know, from the regulator on a regular basis. You know, hopefully they're attending conferences and they're getting that direct impact and how we had in this conversation right now, materiality. But there's materiality that's qualitative and quantitative. And I think the cyber rule is a very good example of the regulator really coming at that from both angles, right? You can say, okay, it was immaterial because it doesn't impact EPS. However, we lost our largest customer. And so going forward, our revenue is going to drop off because of a cyber incident that maybe went unreported, was not timely reported. That's going to be an issue. We also see clauses in contracts, whether it's with a vendor or with a customer, that if you have misconduct, whether it's cyber, whether it's maybe quality product issues, that's another common one that comes up, there can be significant financial ramifications, right? To you're in breach of contract at that point. And that breach of contract can be material, right? So you need to get, it's not just the financials of it cost us X millions to fix this issue, or we overstated, you know, the value of a particular property. It is also kind of that future impact. Because when I think about share price, the share price is really not just the history of the company. It really is baked into what is the future of the company? What does that look like? So when you think about a regulator like the SEC was very concerned, right, about securities, if the value of your shares is highly overstated because you have said our pipeline is too high, this product is ready to go to market when it hasn't been approved, maybe by another regulator like the FDA or someone, you have to be thinking about that. So these types of allegations, while we've talked a lot about financial, can go really into other categories, product safety, recalls, the ability to go to market on something. And so we have these issues where materiality has this quantitative aspect, right? But also is very qualitative, right? If everyone thinks this is the newest, hottest product in pharma, and you've said you're ready to deliver in the next 6 months, and really that's not true, then you probably have a material issue on your hands. So it's not going to be a result of restatement of your financials. So that's something to be thinking about in these types of investigations. I think the one stakeholder we didn't talk about, but I, you know, as a former auditor and Amy's a former auditor, we always want to say, don't leave your auditor behind. You want to have communication, but you have to be thoughtful, you know, and Patty can probably comment a little bit in a second about thoughtful communication with your auditor, which means probably not everything, but no one wants to be in a position at the audit committee that your auditor was unaware of an investigation ongoing. They issued an audit opinion and maybe a clean opinion, 10K went out the door. When they get the results of the investigation, they have to retract that. You don't want to be in that position, right? But also you want to make sure that your auditor is aware of what's going on because they need to adjust their audit procedures oftentimes, right? And they can do that effectively, or you need them to put pencils down. Like, we're already investigating something. We kind of need you to step aside. Please focus on something else, you know, with your time right now, another topic area, because we're already here. We have forensic accountants on board. We're going through this particular account in this particular region or this segment. So give us a moment, you know, to get organized of what the issues are with that account. So your time would be better spent maybe testing, you know, a different segments, you know, AR right now. We know there might be a potential issue here. So you also want to be thoughtful about your auditor's time, and that's their time is not free. So I know we're always trying to manage costs, right? So that's something to be thinking about too.
Now, it's an important concept. These types of things become very time consuming and very costly. And one other aspect that I know you guys had both discussed was the thought process where there is a restatement as a result of this. You also have to think about your company's clawback policies if senior executives were involved, right? So, you know, you think about that, and all of these things and the rulemaking as of late go hand in hand with all of these in terms of trying to drive good financial reporting and reliability of financial markets. So I think this was a really good conversation. So the things that I've come away with in my mind is having a strong audit committee that has financial expertise to really understand what's happening and potential impacts to the financials is really important. Having a playbook or a procedural checklist to use if needed. You don't want to be making this stuff up as you go. You want to have a good action plan because these things get pretty hairy pretty quickly. And then first and foremost, staying calm on, you know, considering the scope of the allegations, how you're going to protect the data and plan an appropriate response carefully all kind of goes back to your ability to weather the storm. So I appreciate both of you. Thank you for joining us on the program today. Look forward to having you both back and talking about other hot topics of interest to board members. So thank you both.
Thank you, Amy.
Thank you, Amy.
All right. Well, take care. And to our listeners, please continue to tune in to BDO in the Boardroom.
Thank you for listening to BDO in the Boardroom. Past episodes and related insights are available at BDO.com/BDO Boardroom. Or you can go to iTunes or Spotify to rate, review, and subscribe. The views expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of BDO. For more information on the BDO Center for Corporate Governance and Financial Reporting and the resources we provide, visit bdo.com/BDO knows governance.